I'm guessing that of all the U.S. presidents, Teddy Roosevelt would have to be the most exciting to portray.
I think so. You know, there have been a lot of them, and there have been some very interesting and colorful presidents, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, Franklin Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Lincoln, not to mention my own favorite, the third president, Thomas Jefferson. But probably if you were adding up life energy and basic vitality and sheer fun, Roosevelt would be the bulliest of all of the presidents in American history.
So what's it take then to portray Theodore Roosevelt? I'm imagining that it's a very energetic portrayal.
It is. It's actually exhausting. I do a number of different historical characters, Meriwether Lewis and John Wesley Powell and J. Robert Oppenheimer and Jefferson, but of all of the characters that I've ever undertaken, Roosevelt is the most fun and by far the most exhausting. And when I'm done, after 30 minutes or an hour, I'm sopping wet. It's appalling to portray him for 1 hour and try to exhibit the energy that characterized his entire 60 years is just exhausting. It's exhausting for me. I think it's exhausting for the audience. And you come away thinking, what was the engine that drove this fellow? Where does this vitality come from? And nobody who met him, even people who disliked him and profoundly disliked his view of the world, could resist him because there was such an ebullience of spirit in him and a joy of living that it just overwhelms your capacity to really step back and think critically about him. You know, you can think critically about the life and work of James Madison or Grover Cleveland, but when you're in the presence of Roosevelt, and I'm not an actor, I'm really just a scholar, but the energy of it is overwhelming in all sorts of wonderful ways.
You said that you're not an actor, you're a scholar. How did you begin doing the historical portrayals?
I'm a North Dakotan, and the director of the North Dakota Humanities Council, a man named Everett Elbers, asked me to portray Jefferson many, many years ago for a conference. And I was just a mild-mannered English professor, and I agreed to do it as a favor to him. I had no background in theater of any sort. I'm really a shy person and not very comfortable in a costume, but I did it as a favor, and then I realized what an extraordinary teaching tool it is, that you can, if you dress up as Thomas Jefferson or Theodore Roosevelt or Jean-Jacques Rousseau, you can get at some issues in the history of ideas and in biography that can't be had by looking from the outside in, that it's one thing for Thomas Jefferson and slavery to be discussed by a professor somewhere, but it's an entirely different thing to be Jefferson and have to answer questions about slavery. And so when I realized that this was really a remarkable pedagogical tool, I wanted to do a lot more of it.
To be able to inhabit a historical figure like Thomas Jefferson or Theodore Roosevelt, you must have to do a tremendous amount of research and really get to understand as much as you can, not only about the life and times, but also the personality of these men.
Yeah, you couldn't be more right. I come at it as a scholar, so I read biographies, probably 4 or 5, sometimes 10 of the character. Then I read secondary studies of the world of Theodore Roosevelt or the world of Meriwether Lewis. I read critical studies of their writings. I read their actual primary source documents wherever possible. Roosevelt wrote 150,000 letters and 40 books. Jefferson wrote 25,000 letters, but they're amongst the greatest in the history of the English language. So I do all of that. I try to immerse myself because this is not a one-man show that I do. No two performances are alike. I really just speak off the top of my head, and I try to tailor whatever I say to the moment that I'm in and the audience that I'm with. And so if you do a one-man show, you have a script and you memorize it, and then you master that and everything follows. But if you're just doing this and you take questions on top of that, then you have to be ready to answer any question about this historical character. So it's a wonderful way of really immersing oneself in the life and times of somebody as interesting as Roosevelt.
In these question and answer periods, are you ever stumped?
No, I haven't ever been stumped except once as Jefferson, and it was long, long ago, and a fifth grader somewhere, I think it was in Idaho, said, "Who were your guardians after your father died, Mr. Jefferson?" And I couldn't answer, and I was so ashamed that she only asked this because she wanted to know. This couldn't have been an encyclopedia question. This must have been a question that came from some personal experience. And when I couldn't answer it, I said to myself, I am never going to be stumped again. I am absolutely never going to stand on a stage if I am not able in some way or other to answer any question that's put to me. And I'm sure that I could be stumped 100,000 times under the right circumstances, but I've been very fortunate and lucky since.
Now, if someone was portraying Richard Nixon or John F. Kennedy or Ronald Reagan, we have movies, we have television press conferences. There's so much documented. We can see them moving and talking with Thomas Jefferson and Theodore Roosevelt. We don't have that, at least with Theodore Roosevelt. I don't know if there are any audio recordings or films that exist, but how do you go back and portray these men?
With someone like Jefferson, I just speak in my own voice because we literally don't know how he sounded or what his gestures might have been. We do know that he had a high-pitched and weak voice, but I don't try to emulate that. I just speak and try to make sense and hope that the audience will forgive me for speaking in a North Dakota accent. But with Roosevelt, we actually know what he looked like and we know what he sounded like. There are about 9 pieces of audio. And by the way, I'm the director of the Theodore Roosevelt Center at Dickinson State University in Western North Dakota, and we are digitizing every known piece of Roosevelt, his letters, cartoons, newspaper clippings, etc., diaries, and we have all of those 8 or 9 pieces of audio, and his voice, we're trying to digitally remaster it, but his voice is very high-pitched and very shrill when he gets excited, a kind of a falsetto, and he tended to snap off his words as if he were biting something. So we know a fair amount about that, and therefore I feel compelled to try to recreate some of that. It's pretty annoying to me and probably to some members of the audience because he was so excitable, but that's how he sounded. And I think it's important when we know what John Kennedy sounded like or know what Winston Churchill sounded like that the person performing it should at least attempt to get within that zone.
Theodore Roosevelt had a close connection to North Dakota. What was that?
Yeah, it was a great connection. And by the way, these are just outstanding questions. Thank you. Roosevelt came to North Dakota when it was still Dakota Territory in September of 1883 to kill a buffalo. And that was his purpose. And because of the Northern Pacific Railroad, he could actually get to Western North Dakota. He could not have gotten to the Black Hills because there was no rail service there. Otherwise, probably he would have gone to South Dakota. But he came to North Dakota, he got his buffalo, and he fell in love with the badlands of the Little Missouri River Valley. And he invested first in one ranch, the Maltese Cross, and a year later in 1884 in a second ranch, the Elkhorn. And he became a cowboy and a big game hunter and a rancher for the better part of 5 years between 1883 and 1889. And he later said that if there were only one experience of his entire life, and that includes San Juan Hill and everything else that he ever did, if he could only save one experience and no other, the memory that he would most want to relive was his time as an authentic cowboy and rancher in Western Dakota. And he said in 1910 in Fargo, "I would never have become the President of the United States had it not been for the time I spent in North Dakota." So we North Dakotans don't have a very rich history. You know, we have Lawrence Welk and we have Theodore Roosevelt. So every North Dakotan is required to memorize that statement at birth. "I would never have been president had it not been for my time in North Dakota," because we lean on this. This is our president, and we're thrilled to have him and thrilled to share him with South Dakota and Mount Rushmore. After all, the Dakota he came to in 1883 was all of Dakota Territory, which includes the current states of both South and North Dakota.
Why was it that Theodore Roosevelt thought he wouldn't have become president if he hadn't had that time as a cowboy and a rancher in North Dakota?
Well, it toughened him up. He was a fragile person physically. He had had almost terminal childhood asthma and a range of other maladies. He was what he would call a 98-pound weakling. So he toughened up. He also realized that what he called the glory of work and the joy of living was something bigger than living in Manhattan and going to social clubs and spending your time with the elite and the aristocracy of the United States. He realized that the people out here may not be able to speak Latin and may not enjoy Italian opera, but they had a depth. They were fantastic in a crisis. They had a work ethic that was outstanding. They had character. And he gained something, a kind of small d democratic spirit while he was out here. And he also realized something about the jeopardy, the threat that was coming to America, you know, the wholesale industrialization and runaway capitalism following the Civil War meant that the great resources of the country, Yosemite and Glacier and Rainier and Devil's Tower and the Black Hills, were going to be stripped by forces of corporate capitalism that had no check on them, no governor. And so his conservation philosophies, he became the greatest conservationist president in American history, were born by his real experiences in the West. To put it in a nutshell, when he killed his buffalo in September of 1883, there were only about 2,000 buffalo left on Earth. And he realized, if I want my sons and grandsons and their grandsons to be able to kill their buffalo, we have to conserve these species. We have to conserve timber and conserve rivers. And we have to set aside some of the most magnificent places in the American West as permanent recreational zones for humanity. And so for those reasons and others, this experience, which could have been in Wyoming, it could have been in Colorado, it could have been in South Dakota, but it happened to be in Western North Dakota. This was the critical maturation experience of Roosevelt's life.
Well, for you as a North Dakotan, that must be one of the exciting things about being able to share the life of Theodore Roosevelt.
Yes, I've portrayed some South Dakotans, including Hamlin Garland, and I'm not parochial in the sense that I don't just enjoy North Dakotans, but here was this great man, you know, one of the Rushmore Four in historical surveys, always one of the top five presidents in American history, who was transformed by an experience in the Dakotas, and without which he could not have become the Roosevelt that is depicted on Mount Rushmore. There's something wonderful in that, and it affirms something that I believe very strongly about the Great Plains and the Dakotas. So for me, it's a joy. I actually moved back to North Dakota 9 years ago from elsewhere, and I took on Roosevelt to reimmerse myself in North Dakota. And the question I asked myself at the time was, what did he really mean when he said in 1910 that he wouldn't have been president without his North Dakota experience? Was that just a kind of Richard Nixon politician's throwaway line flattering the local people? Or did it mean something deeper? And what I've discovered is that it meant everything to Roosevelt, that the critical transformative experience of his life came here in the Western Badlands. And without that, he certainly would have achieved great things. But he thought he could never have been the national larger-than-life figure that he became without that experience. And so I want to find a way to cherish that at the Roosevelt Center in Dickinson, North Dakota. We're going to be at the Theodore Roosevelt National Presidential Library here soon, but also to make sure that North Dakotans understand that this place can produce that kind of greatness.
Now, you were a consultant on the Ken Burns series that we'll see this month, The Roosevelts. What was your role in this documentary?
Well, I'm such a deep admirer of Ken Burns. I've been in several of his films, the Jefferson documentary in 1998, the Lewis and Clark documentary, the National Parks, but now The Roosevelts. I'm in the first three episodes, I believe, as a talking head, and that's just a thrill to wind up in one of his great documentaries is one of the great honors of my professional life. But I was also a consultant to the film, and I've had a chance to do this on several of his films. And you go to Walpole, New Hampshire, where he has his home and studio, and you sit in this room while he edits, and it's an amazing process. I mean, this is a true genius. He has taught America its history. And Ken Burns' films have really become the schoolmaster of America, and he's one of the great talents in American life and, you know, has literally revolutionized the nature of documentary film, and to sit with him and to watch his mind at work and to be able to say, well, what, you know, that fact would be more appropriate in the next episode and maybe less so in this one, and have him take that under advisement is just a pure honor. And so now I'm in this terrible position. When I last saw the film, I was a big presence in the first three episodes. I don't know if I'm on the cutting room floor or what. I'll see. I'll see when I watch it. I'll be watching it like everybody else in a couple of weeks, and I, of course, won't be just watching for myself. I think it may be Ken Burns' greatest film, and that's a big thing to say after Baseball and Jazz, and particularly the Civil War. But as I watched it in his editing chambers in New Hampshire, 14 hours, I thought this maybe is his greatest work ever.
Well, Clay Jenkinson, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us on Dakota Midday, and look forward to seeing you as Theodore Roosevelt when you come to Rapid City.
I cannot wait to get into South Dakota. I shall be there Friday.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.